This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 41 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Max.
Good morning, David. We are accommodating some scheduling issues, and as a result, we're recording this practically at the crack of dawn. And I don't know how this is going to sound, David, since I don't think either of us are really completely wide awake at this point.
I guess people don't realize that we usually record this on a Thursday night at about 9 o'clock. Well, we're doing this on a Tuesday morning at little past 7 a.m. So we're drinking lots of water and lots of coffee. And so if our voices don't sound normal, it's because
we're not normal.
But we are doing this so we can get this out on time. So we're sacrificing for you folks.
So, David, what are we looking at this episode?
Well, UAS regulation proposals. How surprising. But we're going to do a little bit from Australia as well as the good old U.S. of A. And then we've got, everybody loves these, a top 10 list of the 10 best drones. NASA using a Predator to do sense and avoid. And bright job prospects for those with UAS skills. Does that include UAS journalist or podcast? Do we have a bright future in this?
No, I haven't thought of it that way, but maybe that applies to us as well.
And our first story, folks, is CASA. CASA rule changes. CASA is the Australian equivalent of our FAA here in the United States. And they released a NPRM. Did we have that acronym in our list?
I think we should. A notice of proposed rulemaking.
And it was released on May 14th concerning RPAs, another acronym, or remotely piloted aircraft for commercial operations. It does exclude model aircraft used for recreational purposes, but does have provisions for a low-risk class of RPA with a gross weight no more of 2 kilograms. I guess here in the U.S., we would call that an SUAV?
That's right. So they've kind of identified and broken out this class of light RPAs. And the proposal from CASA states that the requirements for a remote pilot or RP certificate or an unmanned aircraft systems operator certificate, a UOC, will not apply to these low-risk, less than 2-kilogram RPAs. Well, that's causing some bit of, well, comment from at least the pilots in the audience. We have an interesting article that Ben Sandilands, our friend Ben, wrote in the Crikey blog down in Australia, titled Australia's Low-Risk Drone Strike Stance Could Bring Down Airliners. And among the points that Ben brings up is he quotes Trent, who's a hobbyist UAV pilot and a commercial pilot as well. And he's not really happy with this, is he, David?
No, this is one of those backpedaling, but Australia's been pretty moving forward with regulation, setting standards and such. And this is, it's almost like the bureaucracy just, we're just going to close our eyes and ignore this class of aircraft and the risks that's involved, where they were taking steps that people were going to be certified and there were going to be standards. We're just going to sort of ignore this. And they're going back to treating it as a model airplane, I guess would be the best way to pose. But for the pilots, it's kind of frightening because they aren't going to be regulated, and they want every UAV regulated. it's an all or nothing, and it's kind of an odd stance for CASA, considering they've been so active on the subject.
Yeah, Trent writes, I believe CASA is trying to remove any responsibility and governance for this fast-growing aviation sector. He says, in my opinion, this is a dangerous prospect. In comparison to the United States of America, their FAA has banned the use of RPAs until they can correctly regulate them. He says, I do not support the banning of these aircraft, rather the correct regulation of them. Trent provides some proposals, what he would like to see in this area. He says, my proposal for hobbyist operators is that there's a requirement for a small education package, no more than 20 minutes, that must be completed before purchasing this equipment, something that would make users aware of the rules and the environment they are operating in. That's the first part. And also an online production of no-fly areas as controlled airspace, restricted areas, and helicopter landing sites. And people can use this as a quick reference document before they fly. That's for hobbyist operators. And he has a proposal for commercial operators of these small craft below 2 kilograms. First is completion of formal training about the aviation environment they're operating in, the basics of law, meteorology, etc. Also, completion of formal training for their specific aircraft to be operated. Also, hold an RPAS small craft license involving a test flight, which can be part of the specific aircraft training that he's mentioned above. Also, hold an aviation security identification card, or at the minimum, an aviation identification. And finally, hold public liability insurance to protect the public in the event of an incident, like any normal small business would. Responses to CASA are due by June 16th. So if you've got some thoughts on this NPRM, and presumably if you're in Australia, which I know a lot of our listeners are, this is the time to make your thoughts and comments known to CASA.
But I will chide Ben. I wish we would not go off the deep end and everything is Australia's low-risk drone strikes standing could bring down airliners. Okay. Ben, we need to take a step back. Not every drone is going to take out an airliner. We like Ben, and just it's a little chiding, and it probably might not have even come from him. It might have come from his editors, because we know that these articles get sent up and they are to be read, so therefore headlines change. But we do have some other good news. This was from Grant, our fellow podcaster from Down Under. If you know, listen to our other show, you know Grant's part of the Australia desk. Certified UAS operators in Australia hits 100. So CASA must be doing something right, because there's 100 certified operators. And in the United States here, we have 2.
Yes, something much lower. This was announced by the Australian Certified UAV Operators Association. So that's good for Australia that they have 100 certified UAS operators.
Believe it or not, the injured part of this article that I really thought was interesting was their first UAS certificate was issued in November of 2002.
Wow.
For something that we've talked about has rapidly changed in the last 41 weeks that we've been doing this, in 2002, UAVs weren't, or a UAV to be certified wasn't even on my radar. So clearly Australia is ahead of the game. But let's talk about top 10 lists, huh, Max?
Yeah, there's always top 10 lists. And this one comes from the editors at Favable. And they made a list of the 10 best consumer drones that you can buy today.
It's diversified, you know, and there's something here for everyone. And they really weren't in any particular order. Would you agree? This is not one of... Here we have in David right. Letterman's top 10 list, where he always works from the top to the bottom. These were 10 interesting UAVs. Number one and number two was the Parrot AR drone, you know, 2.0 quadcopter, which can be flown by your phone, and the larger Parrot drone for $350. Those are pretty standard. The next two are?
Yeah, we have the UDI RC U816A UFO quadcopter. And this is a smaller, a very inexpensive copter, $35. Coming in at number four, we go back up the price scale, the DJI Phantom FC40 quadcopter. That's got a Wi-Fi camera, usable for aerial photography, and that's a $500 drone. The next one, David, I'd seen this or something like this, but I didn't know that this was available for purchase.
And that's the RC DaVinci Ornithopter.
It's hard to say this early in the morning.
It is, and it's after $30. But for people who don't know what it is, it's a flapping wing radio-controlled airplane. I don't know if it... I have trouble calling this a drone. Yes, it fits all of the categories, but it really is sort of more of a radio-controlled airplane. But if Leonardo da Vinci had a man flapping, you know, if you flap your wings hard enough, you start flying. So it's an interesting RC toy. The next one's a little different on the price scale, which is $60,000 now.
Ouch.
But Hemmacher Schlemmer, that's what they do for a living. It's a company out in Texas that has an interesting Christmas catalog, and they sell things that most people don't like. Lamborghinis that are converted to coffee tables and multi-million dollar, I mean...
Yeah, for those who are looking to find ways to spend their money.
Yeah, for those of us who don't have any money, it's a very fun catalog to dream with if we ever hit the lottery. But they have a fire-breathing dragon UAV.
Yeah, I don't know why they put this in the list. I guess it's kind of amusing, but obviously not really something that is anything that our listeners are going to be interested in. At least I assume. The next one is a little bit more back down to earth. That's the 350 QX are ready to fly, running for about $420. And then there's the HT450 quad ready to fly with multi-Wii for $350. And then two more on the list, David.
Yeah, the AeroSky quadcopter for $240. And the Hero RC H911 450, which is another one of those micro UAVs. So it's an interesting list. Definitely, it's the feedback at UAV Digest. If you think that there something should have been added or something should have been subtracted, or we're just off our rocker that the fire-breathing dragon for Hemmacher Schlemmer. You know, Max, I think what we need to do is we need to write Hemmacher Schlemmer, and we'll offer, if they give us the $60,000 flying breathing dragon, we'll be offered to do a review of it for our listeners.
Yeah.
That way we could play with it.
I'm doubtful that they'll bite on that, but hey, it's worth a shot.
And folks, we do it for you. We'll take the hit and do it for you.
All right. What's up next?
Well, if we're going to talk about taking hits, let's talk about not taking hits. And NASA wants to use a Predator for Sense in a Void, so it can play nice with airliners. In this case, they want to use one of their Predator drones, an MQ-9, and two aircraft, and they want to fly them in the same airspace. Now, this is a follow-on to the tests that they were doing at Langley with their SR-22 Cirrus and a Cessna, I'm not sure which version of it is, I believe it was a Skylane. But they were flying the SR-22 as a unmanned aircraft, even though there was a guy in the back seat. In case there was a problem, it really was being flown from the ground, and they were using it for Sense in a Void. This is the next step, is actually taking that research and doing it with an actual UAV, in this case, an MQ-9.
And they expect to start this testing early in 2015. They're going to do this over the Armstrong Flight Research Center in California. And I guess the testing is slated to run for about a year, that the testing will conclude at sometime in 2016. So this is going to be a fairly extended period of data collection. And it'll be interesting to see what they learn from this, how well the software is able to perform the sense and avoid function.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, the Armstrong Flight Research Center is actually the Dryden Flight Test Research Center, which is adjacent to Edwards Air Force Base. They just renamed it a couple of weeks ago after Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon. So it's out in a secure area. We're not doing this over local areas like they were doing the sense and avoid over Langley. But we'll have to follow it. And I have some friends in that area, and we'll see if we can get somebody on from NASA to talk about this.
Next item is kind of a good news item as well, isn't it, David?
It is, Greg, and this and timely too, considering it's graduate season. I know that here in Philadelphia, every day there's some new traffic announcement saying Penn's graduating, or Drexel's graduating, or my alma mater Temple's graduating. But graduates with drone skills are going to soon be in demand.
Yeah, the article is in Stripes.com, and it says that basically if you can design or build or operate drones, then you know what? There's a bright future ahead for you. We've talked about this kind of on and off, David, and we can go back to the report from the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, this report from 2013, which says that we could see as many as 70,000 new jobs in the United States within 3 years in this industry, and 100,000 new jobs by the year 2025. So we're at the beginning of something that has the promise of being pretty big, and those who are interested in this field really have some opportunities coming up.
Let's hope that this grows, and it also benefits us sort of UAV podcasters. It's good news in an industry, and the aviation industry seems to be shrinking, you know, due to military contracts and other things. This is a positive. And again, we need the FAA to step it up a little bit so that these people will be able to have jobs, because if there's still no regulation when they graduate, it's going to be kind of tough.
Yeah. And this is kind of a different sort of a thing. You know, oftentimes I think that when something new comes along that offers the opportunity for a lot of, well, jobs and economic value, a lot of times we don't see it coming. We see it in hindsight, but we don't see it coming. This one is different. This is one that we can look ahead and say, you know what, this is going to be big. And if you're interested in participating in that, you can get ready for that. You can prepare for that. You can learn how to fly. You can get the education that you might need in order to play a active role in this industry. So the time to just sit on the sidelines and watch it go by is that's not now. Now is the time to take some affirmative action, really, and prepare yourself if this is what you want to do.
And the other part about that is the education is being recognized. So, you know, last week we talked about Embry-Riddle forming a graduate class on UA. The schools are also on ahead of the curve and catching the wave. So you'll be able to find, if you're young and you're not like Max and I, which are over the hill as far as catching up on UAVs, but if you can jump in now, the water's fine. And where a lot of times you hear these stories about graduates coming from schools not finding jobs, this isn't going to be an industry where you're going to have that problem. So,
for sure.
Good for our graduates. All right, time to talk about our favorite segment of the week, Max.
The video of the week. We have something a little bit different. We received an email from Andrew at a company called HDR Log, who I don't think he really intended for or was really asking us to make this a video of the week, but he sent along something that's a little bit different. It's about software. It's not about hardware.
Most people are aware now that they have their phones about HDR. I'm still learning it because I'm an old school photographer, and I prefer shooting with that stuff they call film. That being said, the software that that Andrew was talking about was to convey HDR still shots out of video. So everyone's shooting high def video, and this software will take that high def video and be able to make it into HDR stills. Max, you're more versed on the HDR. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, HDR is high dynamic range. And what that means, what dynamic range means, is if you have an image, the dynamic range is the difference between the brightest part of the image that still has detail and the darkest part of the image that still has detail. And the human eye has a huge dynamic range. That's why when you look at something that's backlit, let's say, somebody standing out in the yard with the sun behind them. You can still see the details of their face. It doesn't go black, but you can also see the details in the grass behind them or in the clouds and sky. Film has less of a dynamic range, and digital cameras have even less dynamic range. So the blacks go, so the dark parts of the image go black, and the light parts of the image go white. So with still photography, what you do is you take a series of images, some underexposed and some overexposed, and then you put them all together into a final image that takes the best parts of each of those images. So what this company is doing is using something they're calling stacking and morphing technology that extends this HDR concept to moving scenes, to video. What they have is they have a video on YouTube, and we'll have a link in the show notes, is our video of the week. It displays some video taken from a drone, and then the stills that are that come from that that have this technology applied, and the images are much superior. So it's just something that is being developed and has the promise of helping you produce better images from the videos that you create with your quadcopter or whatever your platform of choice is.
So, Andrew, thanks for sending that in. All right, feedback. The first one was from Roy. Hi, guys. Love the show. I'm learning a bunch, and you guys always make it fun to listen. Before I drone on, quote, Paul Bertarelli has two recent posts that I hardly agree with here, and we'll put them in the show notes. Question, why should the FAA do about small UASs? And UAVs chafing, parentheses, rightfully against regulation. Both articles sort of are railing against the FAA, drink, and in this case, it's 7 o'clock in the morning, that would be coffee. And UAVs are different than legacy aviation. Of course, our friend Trappy has come into the conversation also.
Yeah, I think the first article, the interesting point was that, and we've said this before, is that general aviation needs to participate in this conversation about UAS. If you're a pilot, you obviously have a lot of interest in what the FAA is doing or not doing. And so general aviation folks need to be part of that conversation. And then the other article, it was interesting, I think one of the points was that, you know what, UAV people and enthusiasts of them are different from, well, I don't know, what I can call maybe legacy aviation. The UAV people are historically relatively unrestrained or unconstrained by regulations. They're used to fast technology pace, and they are kind of they have a different mindset than the traditional people in aviation, pilots and so forth. And so, I mean, that's something that you really kind of need to keep in mind. It needs to be part of the understanding about these two forces that sometimes butt heads and have different opinions.
But I mean, it's kind of like the people who thought Elvis shouldn't be shaking their hips and the kids who did.
Yes.
There's a lot of analogies over time where, don't be so straight.
So Roy goes on, and he has some interesting comments. He says he was listening to episode 39, and Max's comment he said about commercial use by archaeologists got to me. He says, I really wish the FAA would stop talking about commercial UAV use. I can't see how commercial versus hobby makes a discernible safety difference, and the FAA is wasting precious time splitting hairs. I'm a student pilot, and it's not going to matter a bit to me whether the video from the UAV I hit is sold or merely posted on YouTube. And, you know, I think this is a really interesting point.
I agree. Set up the regulations and then worry about the commercial use later. He's got a point. But the FAA seems to get bogged down in semantics, and their big deal is commercial aviation. And maybe we need to start thinking about there's a general aviation UAV segment, and there's a commercial aviation UAV segment. And maybe they need to work the problem that way, like they would treat normal day-to-day aviation. So as far as they're concerned, everything's commercial until further notice.
Well, you know, when we look at, you know, model aircraft, RC aircraft and so forth, and as we know, the FAA doesn't regulate model aircraft. But there's no distinction made about the use of the, you know, the model aircraft. If it's a model aircraft, could be used for private use or it could be used for commercial use as well. But there's no distinction there. And I think, you know, what he's saying here is kind of the same thing. So just extend that to drones. What difference does it make whether the, you know, the aircraft is being used on a commercial mission or just a hobbyist mission? It should be about what is the aircraft, you know, what are its capabilities and how is it used, not whether someone's getting paid to do that or not. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But he goes on and he says, between the mess they're making of the NTSB case, meaning the FAA, about the fine against Trappy and the recent no commercial UAV rules until 2020 pronouncement, I figure that a lot of people will probably just ignore the FAA and fly their UAVs anyway. And I think we're seeing that, David, aren't we?
I've had a couple of conversations with people, and the attitude at this point is, I'll worry about it when I get a cease and desist letter from the FAA, with the knowledge that they know that only the FAA has one person currently who can issue those cease and desist orders, and there's thousands of people flying UAVs.
I think it's like you said before, you know, the cat's out of the bag, or the, you know, the horse has left the barn.
Pick the analogy, Pandora has opened up the box, and the only thing left in there is a drinking game.
Now, Roy goes on, and he kind of makes an analogy between ultralights. You know, when ultralights were first being developed and used, you know, he says it was kind of a legal gray area, since the hang gliders they were built from were ignored by the FAA in much the same way the FAA currently ignores RC airplanes. Then people added engines to the hang gliders and started flying them from airports. And then he goes on to describe how the FAA kind of successfully has dealt with that, you know, that new kind of aircraft, and how that was brought into the sort of the regulatory framework. He has several things he thinks the FAA should be looking at when classifying UAS. Three things: weight, speed, and type of control. And by type of control, he says he means line of sight, and the pilot has to watch it, or point of view, and the pilot watches it by flying a video feed from the drone, or the third type of control, completely autonomous, no pilot is required. He says it seems like it would be easy to make a category for RC out of something like weight is less than 55 pounds, maximum speed is 55 knots, and control is line of sight or point of view with the line of sight backup. He says then the FAA can officially say they don't care about the category when they're flown in Class G airspace. He says add some sort of car-like vehicle identification number that needs to be on the UAV and registered cheaply, and that the VIN fixes the UAV falls out of the sky and hurts or damages someone or something via the lawyers in the insurance industry.
And interesting, at the top of the show, we talked about CASA, and they basically just took those regulations and are about to throw them out the window. We have a triad of people now. We have pilots, we have UAV operators, and then we have the bureaucrats. And this triad is tug of war. It's not really just between pilots and UAV operators. There's the third part of the triad that's the bureaucrats, who are trying to keep the two separated and and are getting body blows because they're in the middle of the fight. But they're the ones, they should be the bottom of the pyramid, not the top. And right now we've got the top of the pyramid with the smallest amount of ability to do anything, whereas the two other groups of people are fighting between each other. And, you know, if they'd actually, you know what, if they'd actually like work on the whole attitude of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know, and the two groups got together, the FAA might actually do something. So it's, you know, GA needs to start stepping up and working with the UAV people to fight the real fight, which is get the FAA to do something.
Yeah, I think we need a lot of dialogue. And that's, you know, when you have these different interests with different objectives sometimes, other times common interests, like safety, for example. A situation like this, dialogue and conversation is important to getting to a good solution. And, you know, in the case in the United States, my sense is that until the FAA releases their proposal, there's no three-way or four-way conversation going on, right? My sense is that the FAA is not really receptive at this point to input to help them develop their proposal. The conversation doesn't start until after they release it. So if that's the way the game is going to go, then okay. But when the FAA does release their proposal, that's when we need a lot of, you know, good, solid, reasoned, you know, logical conversation amongst all these parties that you mentioned, David.
Well, I guess we should wrap it up here. Max, should we tell them where they can find us online?
Yes, we want to thank you guys for listening. This has been episode 41 of the UAV Digest. You can find us at theuavdigest.com or show notes for the episode at theuavdigest.com/41. You can find us on Twitter, of course, at UAV Digest.
Email would be feedback@theuavdigest.com. Facebook would be Facebook/UAV Digest. And, of course, you want to stream us to Stitcher, to your phone, or you can download us on iTunes. And guess what, Max? We're up to 14 reviews on iTunes, all of which are 5 stars.
Fantastic. Yeah, I want to thank you guys for doing that. That really helps us a lot if you give us ratings in iTunes or in other podcatchers over at Stitcher. And, you know, you can be honest. We have thick skin. Tell us, you know, what you think, what the value that it brings to you. Help other people learn about the UAV Digest. So I want to thank you for doing that.
On that note, folks, we'll see you next week. This is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.
.com/40 for episode 40. David, where else can folks find us?
Our website, of course, is theuavdigest.com. At Twitter, @UAVDigest. On Facebook, facebook.com/UAVDigest. And iTunes and Stitcher.com. And remember, on either one of those two, if you really like our show, remember to leave us feedback. It's the way we get out to the rest of the world, so we can spread the word of good people flying good drones, doing good things. And don't forget, you could always advertise us by purchasing us some swag at cafepress.com/theuavdigest. So on that note, folks, until next week, I'm David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.